It's interesting when you look at, the FDA approved cannabinoids here, and how they interact with the cannabinoid system. You're right, I get the same thing. Well, yes, I was prescribed dronabinol, which is a THC synthetic derivative, and it wasn't effective. And now I'm starting to see cancer patients who are placed on this dronabinol, which is incredibly expensive. It's like $1,000 a month for them to have 2.5 to 5 milligrams of THC. And I have a patient right now who has schizoaffective disorder who was placed on Marinol. And she's actually at high risk for, depression and suicidal ideation on dronabinol. Like, she should be on cannabis.
Exactly.
She should be on the plant because it's a partial agonist at CB1, whereas dronabinol is a full agonist. And that's where you have these potential increased side effects that can be really harmful to patients. And it's like the other nurse practitioner, the physician are like, what?
Botanic Connection. Alles über Cannabinoide in Österreich.
Welcome to the show, Eloise and Carrie. How you guys
Thank
doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm great. I'm great. Well, first of all, thank you so much for taking your time. I'm really excited to have this talk with both of you because I think it's a talk or discussion that it's overdue, especially in regards to the situation in Austria or Europe, European Union, in connection with the scandalous situation with medical cannabis and especially even CBD. First of all, again, thank you so much for taking the time. Welcome to the show. I'll try to make a short introduction of both of you, and if I've if I forget anything, please add to my introduction. First of all, to Dr. Carrie Clark, she is the past president of the American Cannabis Nurses Association. She serves as director of nursing, chair of the medical cannabis certificate program, and faculty in the medical cannabis and holistic nursing programs at Pacific College of Health Sciences. She is the immediate past president of the American Cannabis Nurses Association, as I said, and has been a nurse since 1994 with a wide practice background, including experience within the acute care setting, pediatrics, hospice care, and parish nursing. And Dr. Clark has presented at many national and local conferences, particularly with oncology and holistic nurses, where she focuses on bringing basic knowledge about the endocannabinoid system and medicinal use of cannabis. And Dr. Clark remains committed to including the endocannabinoid system in every nursing curriculum in the world. Yeah, I think that's about it. And have I missed
That
anything,
sounds good.
Carrie?
Sounds like a lot.
Yeah,
Yep.
well, we might even, yeah, maybe even go into the detail because it's really fascinating, both of your, bios. Now let's go to Eloise. Sorry, Eloise, yeah, Eloise Tyson. You are the, Eloise is the current president of the American Cannabis Nurses Association. She's co-founder and the chief visionary officer of Radical Health. Is that how you pronounce it? Or, okay. And prior to that, prior to Radical Health, Eloise founded Green Health Consultants, a medical cannabis clinic that helped patients use cannabis to help treat chronic and age-related illness. Eloise was one of the first healthcare practitioners to bring a clinical dosing regimen to the cannabis space, and she has treated more than 5,000, I think even I read somewhere about approximately 6,000 patients using cannabis. There are very few healthcare practitioners in the United States with a comparable level of cannabis expertise and experience. Eloise previously served on the board of American Cannabis Nurses Association from 2014 to 2016, and in 2015 helped in the development of ACNA's first online core curriculum for nurses, bringing over 8 hours of educational content as well as continuing education credits for nurses. Through Radical Health, Eloise continues to develop continuing cannabis education for healthcare professionals. She has precepted over 25 nurse practitioner students who have shown a special interest in cannabis medicine. And you both have, you know, published in a, you know, bunch of magazines, but maybe you can go into detail about that. What I'm really impressed, to be honest with you, is your, because that's what I love, is your integral, holistic approach to, you know, healing, health. Kerry, maybe why don't you just start off? Have I missed anything? Have I left out anything? Anything in regards to cannabis or medical cannabis that is, you know, maybe also from your personal perspective should be important to emphasize?
Well, I think, you know, you certainly covered a lot there just reading our bios. So I think we're both, you know, really passionate about defining what nurses' role and nursing's role is in the medical cannabis movement. I think we're both really passionate about education for nurses and advocacy for patients. And I know we both have had different efforts that we've done around advocacy. I was very involved in my state of Maine here in the United States with helping to the Yes on One movement, which was the movement to legalize adult use of cannabis, so beyond the medical use. And my reason for supporting that is that I think it helps to end the stigma. I think it helps to move us closer to getting cannabis out of our Schedule One scheduling in the United States, which keeps it federally illegal. And I think it provides opportunities for people to use cannabis who maybe wouldn't use it or are using it in ways that perhaps are not the best, but we can begin to become more open as we begin to accept cannabis as part of what is in nature and can help us to heal. Doesn't mean it doesn't have its side effects. So I think the advocacy part is really important as well.
Eloise, what's your path?
Yeah, my path, yes. Well, I think Kerry did a really nice job of capturing how important it is to legalize cannabis at the federal level, at least here in the United States. You know, we definitely see a disproportionate amount of people of color still being prosecuted and arrested for cannabis use, even though white and black people use it at the same rate. So I think when we legalize it, it helps, like Kerry mentioned, reduce the stigma and, you know, stop creating this system where, you know, we continue to only have cannabis in the, you know, poor neighborhoods and perpetuate this the stigma that, you know, it's bad and people who use drugs are bad people. Because there's so many people that benefit from it. And we need that research to demonstrate, you know, different routes of administration and their effectiveness and different dosages and different cannabinoid profiles that can help patients. And, you know, we're stuck right now in this, you know, Schedule One status where we can't study it. And so, you know, we keep getting that same narrative of, well, there's just not enough research. And I don't think that people who are intimately involved in the industry understand that catch-22 right there. So legalization is really important. You know, we legalized cannabis in 2016 here in California after being a medical state for 20 years at that point. We're at 22 years now. And it's definitely had its, you know, set of challenges. However, we have seen more people accept it and consider trying it. And because I work with the older population, I think it's such an important medicine for them to explore to help improve their quality of life and allow them to age in place and have some relief where other treatments typically don't help them.
Yeah, we still have to go a long way. I mean, you know, the irony is that I see of all the countries where actually prohibition started off in United States under Anslinger, right? Mm-hmm. You know, racist, whatever motives and stuff, you know, in the early 20th century. And of all the countries, it's still an irony that there's more progress, more development, more, let's say, liberalization or legalization going on, even though fragmented and, you know, in different states, you know, different, there's no federal unified law. I get that. But let me just tell you about Austria and in European Union, it's so perverted because, you know, in the process of this legalization wave everywhere on this planet, now it's been verified. There is reports out there where it's been submitted to the European Commission that instead of, you know, trying to legalize medical cannabis for patients, and we have like in Austria 1.5 million chronic pain patients. All right, I just talked to the chairman of the Protection Consumer Agency association, and he's himself a pain patient and a patient and user of CBD. Right. Mm-hmm. So now the pharmaceutical industry, the pharmaceutical lobby, and that's verified, are trying to push for the prohibition of CBD. You know, like right now, you know, the WHO is actually even, it's been a while, you know, that they've actually recommended. I mean, you know, the WHO, you know, where we know, you know, where they get the funding from. I mean, this is surprising me even, but they're saying, you know, first of all, reclassification of cannabis and more, you know, medical research and funding, you know, and sort of, and now the, we are going actually more into the, you know, back to the Middle Ages, you know, like not forward looking, but we're going backwards. So it's this whole perverted situation we have. And that's why I thought it's really important to have this talk with you, and would love to, you know, hear your thoughts. Like, what can we learn? Because I'm totally jealous of your website, because you seem to be, no, not only your website, but you know, how you organize yourself. It's such a unified voice, and it's brilliant what you do, the ethos, the resolution that you put out, you know, your holistic approach. And what is your position on that? Either one of you.
That's great. Go ahead,
Carrie.
So I think that's really unfortunate that that's happening there. It makes me feel kind of sad and mad that people are suffering because they don't have access to this medicine. Sort of as a contrast to what's going on over there in Austria. So Mexico, for instance, has stated that access to cannabis is a human right, because we have this endocannabinoid system and we have this medicine that can help us to heal. It is therefore a human right for people to access it. And then of course we have Canada, where it's completely federally legal now as well. So, you know, I'd be very, very concerned in your country. I wasn't aware that they were moving toward wanting CBD to be completely removed from people being able to access it. I know here what has been helpful for many of us is to, you know, find out who your allies are, reach out to those organizations, who's in support of this, who at sort of that federal or congressional level would be someone who's going to listen to you and support you and help bring your voice forward. And really seeing if you can kind of also combine some of those efforts with other organizations as well, to create that sort of unified voice that you're looking for. And, you know, it's really challenging because of all of the stigma still. When I stood for, people contacted my work, people asked that I be fired, people asked if my work had the same position that I have. I had colleagues that were like, you are doing the wrong thing, but I knew I was doing the right thing. So I think being really clear on sort of what your stance is, knowing who else is in your corner and can help move things forward or prevent things from going backward like it sounds they are, is going to be really important. And I think at this point too, it's great that you reached out to us and, you know, sort of what other organizations that might be in other countries that might be interested in supporting your work that you're doing in your country as well. So,
yeah, I think those are really good points, Carrie. I mean, the stigma is so alive and well that even our colleagues make fun of us and shun us and, you know, call us names like potheads and drug dealers. And, seriously, you know, it's, you know, I mean, you really do. I've had to learn to get tough skin over the years. And I think the value of, you know, the American Cannabis Nurses Association, we're almost 1,400 members strong now across the United States, and we do have some members in Australia and the United Kingdom and even Canada. And, you know, our position really is around education and collaboration and research and advocacy. And you cannot get into this industry without being an educator or an advocate. you know, we're really trying hard here in the United States to bring more education and awareness to the politicians, the ones that are making these decisions for us. I'm excited to announce that the CDC was looking for input from healthcare professionals about pain management and alternative options. And I approached them to speak on cannabis as an option for pain management, and I've been selected. So I will have 45 to 60 minutes to speak with them on September 4th. And really want to highlight the barriers that really prevent not only our patients who are in chronic pain, but also us as clinicians who aren't even allowed to consider this as an option because of drug testing and the, you know, the repercussions that happen as a result of that. We really need to dig deep into the stigma and undo a lot of these, you know, challenges that we have, because the truth is that people are using it. So it's our job to really make sure that they're safe and they're getting safe access and it's effective and they're not, you know, getting these products all over the internet that are potentially harmful. And that's just what's going to happen in Austria if they prohibit it. It doesn't mean people stop using it because you prohibit it. We know that, right?
Yeah. No. So. We've got a critical mass of regular cannabis users. I mean, we don't know how many. Maybe it's 300,000, 500,000 users of 8 million people who regularly, you know, or once in a while they use it, they consume it. So, you know, you can never, so you're right, you know, the stigmatization, the fear of stigmatization, the criminalization, and then on top of that, you've got the heavy hardcore lobbying. If you just knew what's going on, I mean, a couple of years ago, the Ministry of Health, you know, the government, let's just say, you know, put out this, they said, okay, make a report. So they made a report and they brought in all these so-called experts. Now, afterwards, you find out that all these experts or even medical doctors, they are super tight, you know, with a pharmaceutical company called Bionorica, and there's this monopoly in Austria who can actually, you know, grow real like THC cannabis plants, and then they sell them to Germany, where they extract, you know, make this whatever, you know, synthetic derivatives of CBD, and then they sell it back to Austria. So it's a totally insane situation, and where even the politicians of the opposition party says, where are all the reports, you know, the testimonials of the patients themselves, of the doctors, of the advocates? They're missing. So they're either pretending to be stupid, or they're really stupid, or totally ignorant, or, you know, are just literally bought by the pharmaceutical industry. And, you know, surprise, I mean, right?
I think it's ignorance. And I think there's a lot of well-meaning advocates on both sides. I mean, I definitely see in the cannabis industry where a lot of well-meaning advocates will get upset if clinicians, for example, bring any kind of attention to negative impacts around cannabis. For example, you know, I do see THC causes depression. We have seen something called cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome. And the cannabis community will sometimes fight within itself when you see these being brought up. And I think that if we don't do our due diligence and highlight, you know, some of these concerns that we may have, you know, the risks, the benefits, we can't go out there and promote that cannabis is this end-all be-all cure-all with, you know, no potential harms to it. We really do need to study it and understand it, and people deserve that. But we just get stuck in these old narratives. And, you know, when I got into the industry, I started to recognize that prohibition didn't happen because the medical community thought something was wrong with cannabis. It was political, right? So, you know, we have been taught in nursing school primarily that cannabis is a drug, you know, of abuse. We're not taught about the endocannabinoid system or cannabinoids or any of the benefits. So
that's
one
of
changing, though.
Exactly. That's one of the doctors I talked to, actually two doctors who were in doctors of gynecology and, you know, for women's health. And she said all the doctors tell me that they never learn anything about the endocannabinoid system. They don't, I mean, is that really like deliberately left out of the textbooks or medical books?
Well, so it's been, you know, about, what, over 20 years, 26 years, something, since we really started to have good knowledge around the endocannabinoid system. Mm-hmm. And it takes a while for there to be changes, but I think it's also still linked to the stigma with cannabis and a lot of reluctance to add a whole new body system. It's the largest receptor system in our body. It's really one of the master regulators of our body. It supports homeostasis. And yet there's sort of this reluctance because of the stigma to really start talking about it, to include chapters in textbooks. So one of the issues that I see in nursing is that there's a lack of education of all of the educators out there, thousands of educators who haven't been educated about this. So then how will they educate those incoming nursing students if they don't have the knowledge and the tools? And then there's also a lack of baseline education for students coming into nursing school. We don't talk about the endocannabinoid system in regular anatomy and physiology. So they don't get it as an actual body system before they come in as student nurses either. So American Cannabis Nurses Association took a stance on this, that this should be included, the endocannabinoid system and medicinal cannabis, in every nursing program. And then the National Council of State Boards of Nursing here in the United States in 2018 also made a stance that it should be included as well. Unfortunately, even though that was over 2 years ago, you know, things are still really slow to change. And looking at some data that myself and Rachel Parmalee, who's also involved with ACNA, as one of our directors at large and secretary, so she and I collected data around nursing students, and they're not getting the education in their academic settings. So they're going on the web, they're talking to patients. So those are kind of the two main places that our future nurses are learning about this, from finding stuff on the web that's probably inaccurate because 90% of the cannabis information out there is inaccurate, and then talking to patients, learning from patients. And it's great to learn from patients, but on the other hand, our patients want this information from us. So I'm also really pleased that we have a textbook that's coming out called Cannabis, a Handbook for Nurses. It should be out by the end of the year or beginning of 2021. I'm the editor of that. Eloise has a chapter in there from the nurse practitioner or APRN role, the advanced practice nursing role. And it's 9 chapters. It covers the endocannabinoid system, pharmacology, the history around prohibition, the nurse's role, ethics and advocacy, a whole chapter just on CBD, a whole chapter just on research. So we're hopeful that this will be a tool that nurses in academia can use to begin this educational process, to begin to thread the idea of the endocannabinoid system and medicinal cannabis across all of our curricula, but it's still going to take some time, and it's going to take them as well going, you know, to their biology department and saying, you've got to add into your anatomy and physiology class this endocannabinoid system, so that students come in and they're prepared. So we definitely still have a lot of work to do, but I think we're making progress. So
wow, that sounds fantastic. As I said, you know, I think in the United States also, you know, in other countries like Canada, I mean, they've legalized it totally, right? I think they had even to withdraw from the single convention of 1961, which is the essential problem. You know, we are still in this single convention, 1961. And then what I also read on, of course, it's about, that's why I mentioned the resolution that you you wrote on, or you have on your website, resolution regarding the proper scheduling of cannabis in the U.S. Controlled Substances Act of 1970, and the purpose is to reiterate the ACNA support for patient access to whole plant cannabis. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know what's so funny? We are observing that more and more older people, like really like older generations who know still what was the situation like in the early 20th century with all kinds of substances, you know. So they're coming into the grow shops because they have no other choice, you know, and the grow shop, people, they can't really, they're not even allowed. First of all, they're not allowed, but, you know, so that they're seeking advice because they have no other way to go. You know, they can't go to the doctors because they're with one foot into the, you know, in the criminal law. It's really schizophrenic, this whole situation. So this is why, you know, I was really looking forward to talking to you, because I'm like, maybe we can somehow brainstorm together what could be an effective way to, you know, to have an impact. You know, it's still, these voices are still, you know, there's this group and that group, and there's even an ex cop who is like totally against the war on drugs, which I'm going to interview in the next few weeks. So there's, you know, in different fields of expertise, there are people, you know, coming out, or law enforcement against prohibition in the United States. So we've got all these people, doctors, and even a judge in Germany is like totally written a book about it. So there seems to be, I mean, the sentiment has changed, you know, the stigma is still here, but the sentiment somehow has changed. What is your perspective, I mean, on that opposition?
That's a loaded question. Yeah,
sorry. Just,
I mean, it's okay. I love it. You know, the best advice I got early on was act local, think global. It still works, right? You know, we can get sort of, I think, ahead of ourselves in some way of when you see the disparities among the different, you know, globally, when you see the different disparities, and even within the United States, where we have, you know, 33 states plus the District of Columbia who have some sort of medical cannabis program. I mean, you know, the majority of the United States feels that cannabis has medicinal value. So you get to this point where you get really frustrated, but locally, really trying to educate, you know, clinicians, and trying to educate the public, and trying to educate, you know, the politicians, I think are really important. I also have really tried to empower my patients, because they're the ones that are leading the change right now. They're the ones that, you know, go to their clinicians and say, nothing's working for me. And, you know, I was at the pool with Betty Lou, and she's taking CBD, and so I want to try it. And, you know, so you've seen this shift now where patients are advocating for themselves. But again, you're right. I mean, we still have this gap of clinician provider support and education, right? So they do have to go often to the retail stores to purchase their products, and they may not get good, adequate information at that time, which of course means they're unsuccessful. My biggest push right now is that I want some sort of coverage, you know, whether it's for CBD or coverage insurance to cover a cannabis clinician's visit, so that they have the same access to this kind of medical information that they do for other treatment options. Because right now it's all out of pocket. So they may try it once because they've made an investment of a couple $100s and they don't have any more money to invest and to continue to explore it. And it's, I mean, they can have access to their pain management doctors to explore every kind of opioid you can think of, or they can work with their psychiatrist to explore every kind of antidepressant you can think of. And it's, you know, usually very low cost to them. It's just, it's got to change, you know, yeah. So.
The issue with the costs is really a huge problem, because that's going to, if they really achieved, you know, prohibiting CBD, I mean, it will be extremely expensive if patients have to pay for themselves. Whether it's in euro dollars, I mean, it's going to be probably per month, like, could be like 500,000 for, like, you know, average person out there. It's a lot of money. So this is the discussion right now also going on, like, who's going to cover these costs? I mean, do you need like a special access to the chief doctor, whatever, of the, you know, public insurance company here in Austria, where, you know, he signs it off if you're eligible or not. So it's, I don't know, it's a really difficult situation we have, you know, with patients.
I love the idea of the think global and act local. I think that is super important. You know, even things like having a little conference, having get-togethers with people that are interested in the same thing, getting people to read book like, I don't know if you've read Johann Hari's Chasing the Scream, The End of the Days of the War on Drugs. So that's a great book. It's easy to read. You may find that it infuriates you like it does me, but it goes through all the history of prohibition and really kind of lays out this found work of how it's based in racism and how it really all came from the United States. And, you know, it's time to end that. Yeah. But finding people that can come together locally, whether it's a book club like that, whether it's having a small conference with speakers, or even a larger conference, getting the message out on the airwaves, going to news stations, all these kinds of things, looking for groups that might be willing to come together. I think that is an issue when we end up with like disparate groups that are kind of working all for the same thing, but everyone kind of has their own thing in it. And then of course it's very easy for our egos to get in the way. So what are some commonalities across those groups, and what might attract them all to come to one thing, like a conference with speakers from, you know, it might be a virtual conference now. I'm not sure how you're doing over there with the COVID-19, but we're pretty much all virtual conferences over here, but getting people to come together and hear those voices, and to think, you know, like, what can I do? Who can I reach out to? And really encouraging people to be leaders. I think we see this in nursing, but perhaps it goes over into the general population as well, that people think, oh, I'm not a leader, I can't do much. And I really try and empower people that, yes, you are a leader, you have a voice, you can reach out to others, you can express yourself, and you can make a difference, right? We can all make a difference. And I think that's really important, and that we don't get caught in this idea of sort of like, you know, it's kind of us against them, and you know, that things will never change, because things are in reality always changing. So
right now, I totally agree with you that you know, the patients themselves, because, you know, I mean, we always talk about democracy, but I mean, what is democracy if we have 1.5 million chronic pain patients? They should get together and, you know, get over their fears and express, you know, their desires, their you know, what they really need, you know. And I wish it wasn't that, you know, I don't know what to call it. Is it fear? Is it I mean, it's also maybe a mentality thing. Maybe people in Austria are a little bit more conservative and, you know, reserved. And
well, patient groups can be really powerful and really work toward advocacy. Here in Maine, one of our strongest advocacy groups is actually the caregivers. So we have caregivers that can grow medical cannabis for patients. They can grow for 5 patients. And then they can grow for what's called a rotating patient. So they could have a patient that's not like always their patient, but they have a medical card, so they can access cannabis that way. And that group has been extremely vocal, and at our legislature, you know, all the time when the legislature is in session, and, you know, very concerned about the future of cannabis, particularly medical cannabis, now that we're moving toward this state of legalized cannabis, kind of a catch-22 there. We want to legalize to end the stigma, but we don't want to lose the medicinal aspects. So,
right.
Yeah.
The problem is really the, we don't even have like a, you know, partial, some kind of, like in Netherlands, you know, they have, it's not really legalized. It's sort of a, what do you call it, tolerance politics, right? It's sort of a corporation, but it's still, you know, pretty advanced. I mean, it's a corporation between the justice system, police, the mayor of different cities. I mean, I've been there. It works, you know. I mean, when people are always concerned about, like, oh, what about, you know, protecting the youth? Actually, there are coming more and more studies out that actually shows the number of consumers, whether it's in Portugal, United States, or wherever, it's going actually down with the decriminalization or legalization or regulated decriminalization. So, yeah, so that's the problem. I mean, you know, I mean, my girlfriend has a grow shop, and she can, she's an expert on that, but you can sell legally plants, like little plants that have like less than 0.2, 0.3 THC. I mean, it's really ridiculous, you know? So this is why, you know, we created this platform, because, you know, we can't go on like this. I mean, people are seeking help and advice, but we have to, you know, we have to just, you know, reject them, actually.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I don't know if it's fear among the chronic pain patients, but I think in some ways, at least here in the United States, that they sort of become products of their environment, meaning they, you know, they're on these medications that don't really work for them, and they're constantly increasing the doses or adding them on, and you see what we call polypharmacy, and before you know it, they have all these additional side effects of depression and anxiety, and you know, some post-traumatic stress around it, and they just I think they become isolated easily. Chronic pain patients can be. I think that they can feel as though they're drug seeking, that they're being labeled, you know, even when They're getting their medications regularly, prescription form. So I think that we treat them poorly, and I don't think they know how to advocate for themselves. And I think that's what, you know, the role of the clinician really needs to be right now, is showing up in these, in any opportunity we have to advocate for them. I mean, that's what we did locally here. We had 60 of our patients show up to a city council meeting that went on until 1:30 in the morning, because everybody had to have their 2 minutes up at the, and you know, at the time it felt like it was a waste of time because we made no progress in terms of access. And here we are 4 years later in my city, and they're just now going to allow for a dispensary shop to open up. So, you know, it takes time, and it can be, you know, the effort sometimes can be exhausting, but that's part of the advocacy piece, where we just have to keep pushing forward and trying really hard to demonstrate the value of cannabis.
Yeah. You know, what's really surprising, I mean, not surprising, but the patients, I mean, there's just, there's just a handful of doctors who are specialized on CBD or, you know, cannabinoids. So I talked to one of the doctors here in Vienna, whom I know pretty for a long time now, because, so he told me that some of the patients come to him and say, you know, doctor, it's really great what you're giving me, you know, this dronabinol, this sort of extracted CBD. Yeah, it works, but the real stuff, it works much more, you know, by order of magnitude better, you know, first of all, from, you know, it's more effective. And what you also talk, it's really important to talk about the side effects of all these conventional medicine. I mean, it's mm-hmm. once people, I think, understand and comprehend, you know, the difference before and after, I think it's going to become sort of a paradigm shift in people's thinking, right? Not only in patients, but maybe in the general public, in, you know, in the general circle of doctors.
You would hope.
You would hope, yeah, exactly.
You know, I don't know that I, you know, it's interesting when you look at, you know, the FDA approved cannabinoids here, you know, and how they interact with the cannabinoid system. You're right, I get the same thing. Well, yes, I was prescribed dronabinol, which is a THC synthetic derivative, and it wasn't effective. And, you know, now I'm starting to see cancer patients who are placed on this dronabinol, which is incredibly expensive. It's like $1,000 a month for them to have 2.5 to 5 milligrams of THC. And I have a patient right now who has schizoaffective disorder who is placed on Marinol, and she's actually at high risk for, you know, depression and suicidal ideation on dronabinol. Like, she should be on cannabis. Exactly. She should be on the plant because it's a partial agonist at CB1, whereas dronabinol is a full agonist. And that's where you have these potential increased side effects that can be really harmful to patients. And, you know, it's like the other nurse practitioner, the physician are like, what? You know, when you try to talk to them about this as a contraindication, oh, it's just THC. Yeah, but it's the wrong kind of THC. So it's planting these seeds, but it does take a long time to water them and get them to grow and to see change.
I really liked your example, Eloise, where you were talking about just in your local town and the practitioners brought the patients there. I think that's a great example of empowering the patients to be advocates, creating environments where they can be together and where it's safe because there's a lot of them together. And then being led by the practitioners, I think that's just a really great example of what Kevin is headed toward here with how do we create this change. And then this idea that it takes time and it takes effort. And I think we have to think of these things as more of a marathon and less of a sprint. Mm-hmm. That's why, you know, so many of us are committed, and we realize, like, this is a commitment that's going to be years and perhaps over our lifetimes of work to really create the sort of change we need to see so that patients do not have to be suffering in the way that they're suffering now.
Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, with all these, let's say, regulatory, legal, you know, positive pressures that are coming up from Canada, Uruguay, Portugal, Czech Republic, I mean, I would have expected that this would accelerate the process, you know, but you think it's going to take longer? And because I thought, you know, even in Austria, they can't even, whatever, you know, conservative attitude there is or stigmatization, but I think they can't withstand the pressure, you know, one day. That was my expectation. Maybe I'm too optimistic.
Yeah, I think optimism is still good.
I mean, optimism.
That's how I keep myself alive, yeah.
Yeah, I thought when Canada went, you know, federally legal, that we would be right behind them, and we're not. And, you know, but when I look back at the 50 states and where we were 10 years ago and where we're at today, I see a lot of progress. So, you know, it's kind of also like, how do you measure that progress and where are we headed? And we have at least 3 bills at the federal level right now that are all out in committee. So they may end up sort of what we call dying there, that are focused on legalization at the federal level. So, but, you know, at least they're there and they're introduced and beginning to create change. We know that the majority of Americans are supportive of medicinal use of cannabis anyway. So, you know, I think, again, that idea of it's still is going to be some work. And I think also for you in a very unique sort of setting, you know, looking at the countries around you as well, what did they do? What did it take in those kind of smaller countries to create change as well? I do like what, you know, Amsterdam and Portugal have done, moving toward that decriminalization and or tolerance. I'm sorry, not Amsterdam. Yeah, that's a whole country. Amsterdam's a city. Sorry, a little ignorant there, but I do know that. But anyway, you know, I think Portugal's a great example of just, you know, like, just decriminalize it. Get rid of the black market. Get rid of this whole, like, oh, it's like so bad and we're gonna, you know, people have been looking for ways to alter their consciousness and have been altering their consciousness since forever. And for some reason, alcohol is totally acceptable, but everything is not.
Yeah,
else is
yeah,
not, right?
Totally so, schizophrenic, yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, in Germany, they're much more, it's always said, you know, they're better organized. You know, similar to you, you know, it's like the German Hemp Association, they're super organized. They have even their own, you know, super, you know, YouTube channel and a lot of followers. And they do like on a factual basis, they do, they bring in their discussions and their reasoning in the parliament, in the, you know, lawmaking process. So, and at least they, you know, made a little bit, progress since 2017. Patients under certain conditions, they can go with their medical prescription to the pharmaceutical store and get their real medicinal cannabis flowers. It's a drop on a hot stone, but you know, it's better than nothing, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, you got to start somewhere. I mean, if you wait for perfection, you'll wait too long. So it's, you know, just kind of getting out there and getting going and being adaptable and willing to change. I think it's hard because so many people have been in the issue for so long, it can get exacerbating after a while when you just see. I mean, just last year, I gave a talk to physicians at a hospital in Los Angeles. And I was told there's only going to be like 4 or 5 people, you know, that we never get a lot of people at these types of talks. It's like a lunch and learn. It was standing room only by the time I started my talk. And I had had this physician who was, had come up to me right before I gave my talk and started grilling me on things like, you know, I thought this caused schizophrenia and all of those myths and, you know, misconceptions that are out there, right? He just came at me. And I just, you know, answered him the best that I could and then went on to do my talk. And he started to harass me during the talk to the point where I just ignored him because he was very disruptive. And he got very upset that I ignored him. And he stood up in the middle of this room and yelled at me about how dare I come to this hospital and talk about a drug that's so dangerous. And he stormed out of the room. You know, and this is 2019. Wow. So, you know, luckily I'm a seasoned enough speaker that it did not, you know, did not disrupt me. But I certainly afterwards was very just like, wow, that was bizarre. And I was approached by about six different physicians in the room to reassure me that that was normal behavior of this person and it wasn't personal. But, you know, not to be a pessimist, you know, about leading the change and making change, but I do think that I've never seen people so attached to their beliefs around cannabis than any other thing. You know, it's like hardwired in their DNA when they are, you know, anti-cannabis. And sometimes even education is futile. You know, it's what we see is that when people or their loved ones need it that's what I've seen with some of my local politicians is they've sent, now that they know I'm there, they send their family members to me. And that's what's changed a lot that's what's made a lot of progress in our cities, that their family members have benefited.
Exactly. Because they see, they feel the reduction in pain, in suffering, right? Mm-hmm. I think this is a tremendous effect. Right. Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. That's a huge factor. I was going to ask you something about the, is there a preference in the the administration of cannabis? Like, do people prefer to take it, or does it depend on the illness, or I don't know, on the specific disease or symptom or pain? Mm-hmm. Like, is it oil or vaporizing, or what is it that people prefer?
It really depends. I mean, I don't know what you see, Carrie, but most people prefer inhalation. And even though I work with the older population, they usually come to me saying they don't want to smoke it. It feels counterintuitive. But we talk about the risks and benefits of the different routes. Inhalation is often a way for them to have the most control over their experience and to get relief the soonest. If they're still feeling like inhalation is not a good fit for them, I would say tinctures or oils are probably the most popular, at least in the older population.
Yeah, I think, you know, we hear a lot about medibles or edibles where cannabis oil is used to make a product that someone can eat. And now we see it in everything from chocolates to gummies to sodas on popcorn, whatever. But that is much harder to control for a lot of people because you don't know about onset, and absorption rates can really vary, even the same product from day to day for a person, depending on what they've eaten and where they're at. And I think even their circadian rhythms can really affect them differently. So even though people really like the idea of medibles or something delicious that has cannabis in it, you know, I think we always encourage, you know, to be very cautious with those, and for everything to really start low on the THC and go slow as they're learning how it interacts with their body, and kind of titrate up to a dose where they're having good relief from their symptoms. They don't necessarily have to feel high or intoxicated, and they're avoiding the side and adverse effects. So, I do see that people like to inhale because it is a more immediate effect and it feels a little bit more controllable. It wears off more quickly, and then they can use the medicine again if they need to. And of course there are risks with that. And you know, really important too, that patients are accessing medicine that is safe and has been tested and is free of pesticides. So that they know what they're getting. Right. And in some places like Eloise is out in California, you know, going to a dispensary, a lot of that is available. They can actually see what's in the product they're getting. They know it's been tested. They know what the dosing is. And then in other states, maybe not so much. And there still is also, even though we have quite a bit of legalization across the United States, there still is plenty of black market product out there. So,
which could be risky, right? Because you don't know what is inside there, you know, like what kind of herbicides, fungicides, or any kind of metals, or I don't know, you know, any.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a quality. It's, you can never verify. This is why legalization, you know, on top of that, is so important, because you can be sure you can have a guaranteed quality, right?
Right. I mean, can you imagine, like, you know, buying some kind of moonshine kind of alcohol product? I know people do still do this too, but like, you have no idea what's in this product. Or people, you know, that go to music festivals or whatever, like, here's a tablet of something, go ahead and take it. Like, you have no idea what's in that. It's extremely risky, and it still can be the same way with cannabis as well. So that is a great point, that it's really a safety issue and a health issue, and patients deserve to know what they're getting.
Right, right.
Yeah. Transparency.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's still, you know, I mean, this propaganda about gateway drug and, you know, I mean, how in the world are they going to protect the youth? I mean, you know, I studied for 15 years the internal documents of the tobacco industry, because that was my PhD work. I wrote, you know, books and my PhD thesis on. And it's unbelievable, you know, the strategies that the tobacco industry, cigarette corporations have devised for the last, I don't know, you know, for many decades, you know, and even they went into the strategy, like, what if cannabis ever, you know, would be legalized, you know, so they had already worked out the strategy. Mm-hmm. So I just find it interesting, you know, when we have like socially accepted drugs like alcohol and the highly manipulated and highly engineered cigarettes, mm-hmm. it's I don't know, the way it's being argued and discussed, it's really schizophrenic. So, yeah. So before we wrap up, thank you so much again for your time and for sharing your knowledge, your wisdom. Do you have any, like, first of all, where can people find you, or any other, like, anything we can look out for? Collaborations maybe internationally with the American Cannabis Nurses Association?
Yeah, there is the cannabis. There's a group in the United Kingdom, and I know they're called CPAS. And they do have a nurse arm that they're working with. And let me give you the Cannabis Patient Advocacy and Support Services out of the United Kingdom. They're working really hard to provide education, advocate for patients, and also educate nurses out in the United Kingdom. They have approached the American Cannabis Nurses Association about collaboration. It's just something that we, you know, we're a nonprofit organization. Things move a little slower than we probably would like them to. But I could see opportunities for us to collaborate. There's also the Society of Cannabis Clinicians, which also has a European arm, and they have been working with the cannabis nurses to bring more attention to the work that we're doing in the industry. Carrie?
Yeah, and then from a different kind of perspective, so Pacific College of Health and Science, where I'm the director of nursing and the chair of the medical cannabis program, we actually have an academic certificate. Mm-hmm. So in nursing in the United States, you can get board certifications, and ACNA is working toward eventually being recognized as a specialty within nursing, but that will take probably a few more years worth of work. We have to work with some larger organizations on the national level to get that recognition. So in the meantime, we're fortunate to have this program where students can take 8 credits of academic work and come out and feel very, they won't necessarily be experts, but they'll be confident, they'll be comfortable, and that curriculum is open to nurses and doctors. We have chiropractors that come through it. We have massage therapists that come through it. We may have had a few pharmacists come through it, but anyway, so we've had quite a few acupuncturists come through it. Eloise and I also both teach in that curriculum. So
great.
We're excited to also kind of be creating the future and kind of an example of how you can educate healthcare professionals and get them to a level of confidence and feeling comfortable with being their own knowledge and with creating paths for how am I going to grow my knowledge? How am I going to advocate for my patients? How am I going to be part of this amazing change that's happening in medicine and healthcare? So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, I truly see an evolution in comprehension and in, you know, opening up people's perception and consciousness. And I think it's going to happen, maybe, you know, as you know, gradually and subtly. So yeah, so thank you so much again. I really enjoyed our talk, and yeah, maybe we can repeat this sometime in the near future.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah, thanks for having us. I hope you have a good rest of your evening.
You too. All right. Okay. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Bye, Kevin.
Bye.
Bye, Carrie. Bye, Liz. Mehr Informationen finden Sie auf botanicanalyst.com.